This is the Made of Clay Report, Facing Our Lives, and your co-hosts on this episode are Peaches Gillette and Eric Clay. And today we are in search of a way of framing our topic. The issue that I think has the most resonance from what I understand from Peaches is bias and equity and justice. And I feel like we need to front load that a little bit with some of the ideas about what news is and what information is and how we deal with the bias of things that are coming at us so that we kind of think about becoming more skillful. They are very interrelated, but where the accent point falls is maybe a little different. So I have spoken of Peaches, hopefully not for her. And so Peaches, how do you want to frame what we're doing so that we can discover what the topic is today?
Yeah, I like the idea of what you said already. And I love the idea of kind of like starting off really with the news and the influences that we get sometimes without noticing it in terms of how we make decisions about everything, quite frankly. And earlier today, I was just thinking about that. I'm doing a workshop in the high school and thinking about the influences that our children get from the news to be whatever they may not have even thought of being, or to have opinions or to behave in certain ways. Like, we're always pushing the narrative on, especially on teenagers, that if you're a teenager, you have to be obnoxious and rebellious and things like that. And part of that is just our conditioning, and we don't even realize that. You know, when I grew up, I always reflect back to the fact, I always say to people, you know, I grew up with hormones like everybody else, and I did not behave like that with my parents, you know, because it wasn't an expectation. Right. The expectation was to behave differently.
Right.
And so I think that we relinquish a lot of the controls that we do have, and we don't have control over most things, but I think that we relinquish the controls that we do have, you know, to kind of either follow the common narrative or to be a part of the main group or whatever it is. But I really believe that we really need to investigate that more in ourselves.
Right. And when you said that, it made me think of, I did a lot of stuff that could have been framed as rebellious, but I actually told my mother what I was going to do and did it. And she had this rule in our house, you know, anything you do away from home, you just as well do at home. Because if I hear that you're behaving differently out of the house than you are in the house, then you are in trouble. Mm-hmm. That was a common ground piece. So that's interesting, because it wasn't a rebellion for me. My younger brother rebelled ferociously, mm-hmm, but that mm-hmm. was the most, when our father died, he was five, and he was the one who lost in a certain sense the most in a way that wasn't articulable.
Yes.
So that feels like part of his process. When we bring this to the news, I also realize there was like an 11th commandment when I grew up. The 11th commandment was consider the source. And in a small town, in a rural community, everything is trapped, and people are talking about everything and everybody and the wider world and the local stuff and each person and the families and the issues. And you learn to distinguish really quickly between who's a reliable source for accurate reporting, who has strong interpretations that are generally clear or that may be just consistently different than your own, or who's a gossip. Gotcha. Who is trying to put somebody up or put somebody on a pedestal or put them down in order to control them with the narrative? Who's the gossip? And so for me, the news has never been about the facts. It's always been about what perspective am I getting hit with? And it's almost irrelevant what the facts are to support it, unless they're making a strong case that they claim is fact-based. Mm-hmm. But it's a lot about, how do I deal with that perspective? Is it useful? Is it not useful? So for me, the issue.
100%. Yeah, go ahead, Anne.
The issue with the news is us taking responsibility for how we receive the information that the world delivers at to our doorstep, which is usually somebody else's perspective or some group's perspective.
Yes, yes. I completely agree with that. And it all feeds right into our biases. that are looked at as very negative, because there are biases that are not negative in my interpretation. The news to me was, what does that feel to me? What emotional place it puts me in, and how can I use that or absorb that and still stay steady or hopeful or informed about things? But it wasn't, I never thought of it as like, this is necessarily the bottom line fact, because there are always other facts and truths that bump up against other things. So we need to broaden the way we take in information, no matter what, and question it, quite frankly, as far as I'm concerned, you know.
Is there a topic where you have found this particularly important? How do we take in the bias, and take in the news and understand that we're working with bias?
Yeah, I think that it's kind of like a very vague general way. It falls in line with like the way we view politics, the way we view sexuality, the way we view all those things, which also leads right into equity, whatever that means.
Right.
Because we are just not questioning enough. People have a tendency to look for information that affirms what they already believe, when I think it's very important to look for information that actually contradicts what you believe.
Right. Right.
So that, because it can make you either stronger in your argument for whatever it is that you're mm-hmm. feeling. It can make you understand more, maybe some of the nuances of what somebody else is thinking, or your own nuances. And I think that we don't have any tendency to do that whatsoever.
Right. And so here, I'm going to gently nudge what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
What I have read of people who actually study people's viewing and reading habits is that news information, there is a tendency to want to look to sources you already trust. But just like things that are a little risque, people go and read the stuff that they're not supposed to read. They go and read the other side. Uh-huh. And they do that consistently so that nobody is really in an echo chamber. That is kind of a myth we're telling ourselves, but we're not really upfront and honest about how we secretly take in information from the other side.
Right. And I or think other you're sides. Right. Yes, I think you're right about that on some level, but I think that the taking in information, or the hearing it or listening to it,
right,
is not the same as incorporating it into your, right? Into,
or confessing that you've done it.
That's true too. That's exactly right. Yeah. That is right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that all those stages that I feel we're describing are necessary in us for us to really weigh out what we're seeing and even what we're feeling and our opinions about whatever is going on in the world and in life, and how we navigate and incorporate that into our, whether we have, like, for me, it's like, I have a way that I want to be in this world. How do I take that information, even if it's contrary to the way I want to see the world or the way to be, and incorporate that so it becomes a piece of wisdom and knowledge for me?
Right, right, right. But what I hear you saying is that the position that you put yourself in is not one of a decider of what is true or factual, but you are a decider of what you find useful or not useful in living your life going forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think if I have this goal of being, of trying to, let's just use this, and it's kind of goofy, but let's just try to make peace with people. If I have a goal of doing that, what I take in, what I hear, what I listen to, I have to kind of put that into my thinking and say, if I believe that, is it leading me to that goal of making peace? If I follow that practice, if I do that kind of thing, is it getting me to the goal that I want to attain for me on a spiritual level?
Right.
And that's the way I really sort out most of what I think and feel. Mm.
Right. Okay. So you just used another big word there, making peace. I have a feeling that you don't mean intellectual agreement.
Mm-mm.
Okay. So what do you mean by, if your goal is making peace, what is it that your goal is?
That's to kind of not allow myself to be weighed down by what I don't agree with. You know, there's a way that when somebody says something that really, let's say, completely against what I believe, like,
mm-hmm. or what you
say,
value.
Let me say hunting, for an example.
Right.
Like, I'm not, you know, and I could either be offended by that thing, and it becomes a weight in me that every time I meet somebody or somebody who talks about hunting or somebody did hunting, it becomes like a weight that I have to carry around and always feel like I have to defend that thing.
Right.
So what I mean by making peace is to take that in. I have friends who are hunters. Take that in and say, I can look at it, this in a very different way so that it does not weigh on me and create constant conflict, whether the conflict is subtle or not, constant conflict between me and that person. In other words, it's sort of like respecting on some level, because you can respect something, the nature of what somebody does, and not necessarily agree with it in principle. And that being able to split the mind in that way is very important to me. Otherwise,
right,
and, I would just hate people constantly, you know, like.
Right. And that's interesting that you use the expression split the mind, is that you can, the peace with other persons allows for a unity, while the respect allows you for have fundamental differences that you will never agree on.
Mm-hmm.
The example that I will use to kind of further what you're saying, I have a visceral response to pets as being enslaved animals.
Mm-hmm.
And that's even less value. That's even less noble than having animal agriculture, because at least you're honest about what you're doing with them. And they don't simply exist for your amusement in them and their amusement in you. Mm-hmm. I have that opinion. It's very strong. I have it because we had dogs and cats who were not domesticated in ways that most people think of them on the farm, but we were all useful to each other. They lived very independent lives and fed themselves 11 out of 12 months of the year. But when I have that, and I'm at peace most of the time, I don't enjoy playing with pets, but I don't have to let people know what I think, you know. And what's kind of hard though at times is when I let people know what I think and I'm not belligerent about it, it's almost like they sometimes don't really hear it.
Right.
Because the conversation goes on as though I didn't exist, or that set of values. And I don't need to have my values affirmed. This is another thing that this conversation is taking us to. Having respect doesn't mean that they have to, they're respecting you doesn't mean they have to validate you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In fact, you may not be able to validate the hunter as a hunter, but you have peace with the hunter as a person.
That's exactly right.
And the same is true for me with people who have pets.
Yeah, and you know, I also look at it as like we're all caught up in this like web of contradictions, right? Our lives are about, like, total contradictions,
yes.
Right? You know, and I'm very aware of that, and it makes me give more room to people in some ways to just be who they are. If you're going to have a conversation about whether I think it's right or I think it's wrong or I can validate that kind of behavior, that's a whole other thing. If you ask me the question, I want to tell you, don't do that. But if it's just that I know that that's who you are, I'm not going to use that as a measure, especially if we have a full relationship. I'm not going to use that one thing as a measure to be in conflict with you. And I've seen people do that and ruin complete, really, really relationships that would be nice relationships otherwise.
Right. Right. Because holding on to the difference in a way that poisons the relationship destroys peace.
Absolutely. I've seen people who are vegans do that with their friends who are not vegans.
Right.
Over the simplest things. And I think that we just have to be much more sophisticated than that on a spiritual level and just on a human level in terms of the relationships. I'm talking about the world relationships,
right,
that we want.
Yeah,
to
yeah,
have.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Let's take a break for music.
To bring the trauma overseas, yeah, we trying to stop terrorism, but we still got terrorists. risk here living in the USA, the big CIA, the Bloods and the Crips and the KKK. But if you only have love for your own race, then you only leave space to discriminate. And to discriminate only generates hate. And when you hate, then you're bound to get irate. Yeah, madness is what you demonstrate. And that's exactly how anger works and operates. Man, you gotta have love just to set it straight. Take control of your mind and meditate. Let your soul gravitate to the love, y'all,
people
y'all.
People killing, people dying. Children hurt and you hear them crying. Can you practice what you preach? And would you turn the other cheek? Father, 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 help us. Send some guidance from above. These people got me questioning. Where is the love?
Same, always new change. New days are strange. Is the world insane? If love and peace is so strong, why are the pieces of love that don't belong? Nations dropping bombs, chemical gases filling lungs of little ones with ongoing suffering as the youth are young. So ask yourself, is the loving really gone? So I could ask myself, really, what is going wrong in this world that we living in? People keep on giving in, making wrong decisions, only visions of them dividends. Not respecting each other, denying thy brother. A war's going on, but the reason's undercover. The truth is kept secret, it's swept under the rug. If you never know truth, then you never know love. What's the love, y'all? Come on.
I don't know.
Where's the truth, y'all? Come on.
I don't know.
Where's the love, y'all?
People killing, people dying. Children hurt and you hear them crying. When you practice what you preach, would you turn the other cheek? Father, 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 help us. Send some guidance from above. These people got me questioning. Where is the love?
Where is the love? Where is the love?
Where is the love? The love, the love.
I feel the weight of the world on my shoulder. As I'm getting older, your people get colder. Most of us only care about money making. Selfishness got us following the wrong direction. Wrong information always shown by the media. Negative images is the main criteria. Infecting the young minds faster than bacteria. Kids wanna act like what they see in the cinema. Yeah. Whatever happened to the values of humanity? Whatever happened to the fairness and equality? Instead of spreading love, we're spreading animosity. Lack of understanding leading us away from unity. That's the reason why sometimes I'm feeling under. That's the reason why sometimes I'm feeling down. It's no wonder why sometimes I'm feeling under. Gotta keep my faith alive till love is found. Now ask yourself,
where is the love? Where is the love? Where is the love? One world, one world.
We only got
one world, one world.
That's all we got.
One world, one world.
And something's wrong with it.
Yeah.
Something's wrong with it.
Yeah.
Something's wrong with the good world, world. Yeah. We only got
one world, one world.
That's all we got.
One world.
This is the Made of Clay Report, Facing Our Lives. Peaches Gillette and Eric Clay are your co-hosts, and we are having a conversation between the two of us where we're discovering some of our thoughts on bias, equity, news, respect, values. Not that we, this is what we do every week, but every week it's a slightly different, emphasis. So where would you like to go next, Peaches? Is there someplace specific?
Yeah, I think I'd love to kind of dive a little bit more into bias and how it's looked at in general as an evil kind of thing.
Sure.
Where, you know, I feel that we all have biases. Of course, even if it comes to the food we eat, it does not. The word itself does not imply something evil. It just implies that I took a stand on something that I believe in. In the way that I believe in things, and that's where I'm going to, you know, point my opinions.
Right.
It does not mean, in other words, it's like race comes up with that. It's like you don't have to be anti-white to be pro-black or vice versa.
Right.
And
right.
That becomes an issue. If I'm pro something, if I'm a vegan and that's something I truly believe in, If I meet people who are not vegans, my bias is that I have a whole system of belief about animals. Their bias is the other in the right. other direction. And we're all biased. So it's not an evil thing. It's just the way we ground ourselves or center ourselves really in the world that we live in, you know?
Right.
And so I'm always kind of, you know, kind of, what I want to do is explore these conversations more in general, because people don't explore them. They just throw out words and
right.
attach them to certain negativities, and then it never goes any further than that.
Right, right. And you use the word, your bias is your stance. And when I experience you as a human being, I don't experience you standing still.
No, that's true.
I experience you in a great deal of movement, both physically and kind of emotionally and intellectually, messing with things, playing with them, thinking of them, you know. And yet, in a certain sense, that bias is a snapshot. It is.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. That's right.
And for me, the connection, the snapshot helps to connect to my experience of bias comes from a realization of different perspectives.
Yeah.
And I can see things from, if I can't, I can imagine, but I perceive that I can see things from fundamentally different perspectives. Like in 1969, I had an older brother who went to Harvard on a scholarship and played football until his knee got blown out. But he came back after a year at Harvard, looking like a hippie and sounding like a socialist radical. And in Northwest rural Missouri, that was just like, you know, it's just, you know, this guy had an appointment to the Air Force Academy that he did not take. And this is what he's coming back like, you know, what the hell? And for me, I could love him and his changes and the people in the community. And I just needed to kind of position myself. And given in those years, that was soon there, that is just after 1968 and the Black Power hand fist in Mexico mm-hmm. City, and those things influenced me. And I could see, well, Black Power and white power, not white supremacy, but white power, those things, I don't see them as mutually negating, but granted, that's a really loaded thing for me to say now, given the current environment, but living in that space where you have to move from perspective to perspective mm-hmm. if you're going to honor who you're with.
That is very true. The snapshot is the moment in time, right? Because when I'm sitting in at work or something and people hear me go, oh, say whatever, like, I really don't like the anti-Christian attitude that goes on here. That's something right. I believe. It shouldn't go on anywhere. That's a stance I've taken. Right. And there are some stance I take to my grave, but I will still explore them even right. more so, just to make sure that there's still something that is part of who I am, because life is incredible. You know, everything unfolds constantly, is in a constant state of unfolding. And sometimes we encounter perceptions or people even that right. change things in us that we never thought would ever change. You know, so I'm always open to that. But meanwhile, I take a stance on certain issues, you know.
Right. One of the silly stories about my growing up was in junior high, we had some geometry problem that was a real world problem where we had to go out and maybe measure the height of the water tower or something by triangulating certain things. And because of the person that I was in the class, and I was pretty good at math, but I'm also one of these kind of hyper intense guys, and everybody came along with the way that I calculated it, and I was wrong. I was just flat on, you know, so my bias led all of these people, but they had their own minds. I mean, I'm not completely responsible. But what I learned at like the age of, you know, 13 was that you can have an outsized impact on others. And unless you make sure that they're making their own decisions,
yep,
and their own mistakes, then that's really not good. That's not good leadership.
That's exactly
not a good way to be in the world, because then your bias has no check.
That's exactly right. That's right. And even and for ourselves, like if you think that's why we have to constantly go back in and go, let me check that in myself. Let me check that bias in myself and see like the calculation you made. Like, I mean, you were a kid, you know, the time wasn't, you know, necessarily allowed. But you go back in and you go, if you did that now, you'd be like, let me double check that. Let me see if that's actually, if that's accurate. You, and I think that we should do that with everything. Literally everything inside
it. Right. And the thing is that I did double check it, but I was just so convinced that I didn't have, and I didn't give it to somebody else.
Yes.
To just
start
from scratch.
Yes. Yes.
Which is like, you know, if you want to go more of a true scientific method, somebody else has to work it up from scratch, not from your assumptions.
That's exactly, that is
because when it's math, once you set the inappropriate assumptions in place, then you're going to get the same answer over and over again.
That is right. That is exactly right. That's right. I get this image of like sparring, like in a boxing ring, where you have a stance, you have a position.
Sure.
And the goal is to not get knocked off your feet. If you do, you get up and you recalibrate and recalculate what happened. And that to me is the way I feel like I should be and we should be, that if something makes me go, oh, wait a minute, maybe I need to recheck that, you know, then I have to accept that. I have to allow that into myself, as opposed to saying, no, I know I'm right and I'm not rechecking anything, which is what a lot of people do.
Right. And it takes a nimbleness to know, to question yourself. Here's an image that kind of connects some of our other images. Elon College in North Carolina used their mascot up until maybe 30 years ago, 40 years ago, was a man in 19th century dress with his fists up, and they were known as the Fighting Christians. And they were from a version of Christianity which was very similar, kind of a cooperativist version of Christianity that I grew up in. And dueling with scripture and fighting and testing your mettle was what it meant to grow up.
Yes.
And yet that image of fighting Christians now is taken like, you know, these are just the Christian fundamentalist version of Muslim jihadists. Mm. And it wasn't that at all.
Yes.
It was where you know enough of each other's traditions and values that you can really push.
Yeah.
And so the ambiguous parts or the contradictory parts or the hypocritical parts become more clear.
Yes.
In the fray.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that it's funny, and this is not, it may be a little off topic. I think that we have created, and, you know, my friend who grew up in Nigeria, Patricia, I think you met her. Mm-hmm. And she, when she went to even high school, they had to be on debate teams. It was just part of what they did. And so the idea of like, and she's a very passive person. She's not, you know, I love that about her, that she's not somebody like who takes her intelligence and uses it as a weapon towards people. But the idea that it's very difficult to have a conversation, even when you're not deliberately trying to push back, but it comes up in the conversation, a question comes up that feels a little like a pushback, that I can't do that easily with people without them either feeling broken by it, hurt by it, crying, which I've experienced many, many times, or just purely defensive.
Yeah, feeling attacked.
Yeah, and it's really it sets up these limitations of communication that are not only unnecessary, but they don't help us grow at all.
Right. You know? I just want to sit with that image because it's such a, we almost don't know how to say, let me sit with that. Let me just take it in. And maybe come back fighting. But for a lot of people, the fighting rhetoric is really unacceptable. Right. You know, it's just, we have a discussion. Well, you know, if it gets, you know, you physically agitated, even if you're not coming to blows, you're fighting.
Right. But, yeah.
You know, I just, and then this, so what the image that was running through, my younger brother was dyslexic, and it took him several years to figure out the reading thing. But once he got the reading thing figured out, he read every book you could imagine. And he is extremely conservative or redneck, as one might say, but he is incredibly widely read.
Yeah, nice.
And but when he was younger, his way of dealing with frustration and working things out was to physically fight, and so was mine. But it was more. It's not what I led with, but it's what Chris led with, mm-hmm. because that's what he could do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's so. And when he got bigger than me, it's what he could succeed. Mm-hmm. with me, with which was also important and sobering for me. But that's not about fostering violence. That's fostering kind of hard-won negotiation of space and bodily control and respect, and the respect that you were talking about at the beginning.
Yeah. I completely grew up in that environment where, most things ended up in a fist fight. That's uh-huh. just the way it was. There's a sorrow in that in a lot of ways, because the person who fought did not come out of it necessarily feeling any more satisfied than they did when they went into the fight.
Right.
And now they have scars and bruises. But I understand, in that kind of world, how that happens. I mean, we don't want to admit that we have things that we defend. And I think that's another thing that we avoid in this culture, which also is tied to bias. We have things that we defend, we have a territory, a spiritual, emotional territory mm-hmm. that we defend.
Right.
And it's almost like it's looked upon with disapproval, but that's just the human reality. And so if you could use your words and your language, and if somebody's either open enough or willing enough to listen or whatever, you might not come to blows, but often it's like two people standing so hard on their ground and neither one of them wants to be pushed over, or even like end up in a frame of mind where they're saying like, well, wait a minute, what if that isn't true? I think that's part of the hardest thing for some people, to say all that I believe that all of my life, and what if that isn't really true?
Right. For me, there's a level where a lot of fighting is about not knowing how to grieve, and so you go through physical expressions of pain and whatever, and even if you know you're going to lose, you know that by the time the fight is over, you're spent.
Mm-hmm.
And then in that being spent means that you may be open to either letting go or moving on.
Yes.
And I don't put a strong, as long as people aren't maimed or killed, I don't put as much of a judgment on physicality as we live in such a pseudo polite culture. That people will kill you without noticing you, by ignoring you and not addressing your needs. Their bias is so complete that you don't exist, or their words are so sharp and so certain that you have no standing.
Absolutely.
And those kinds of actions are no less violent.
They are not.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that the language that you just use about making people feel like they don't exist, or you're diminishing who they are, that is often what leads people to violence, because they are trying to work out that feeling and find some triumph somewhere. Even like you said, even if they lost, at least they tried to defend something, and that means something.
Right. And for some people, all you need to do is show that you're willing to escalate with them.
I know.
That you're not willing to overcome them. You're not willing to be overcome by them, but you're willing to escalate with them so that you can meet in this world as two forces to be reckoned with.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah, I have a similar. I mean, I certainly am not a fighter, and I don't think I ever was really.
You're tough, but you're not a fighter.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
And part of it because I didn't have any problem walking away.
Yeah.
Or even like squirming away, and kind of thinking about what just happened. So I always had kind of an out to fighting. It wasn't mm-hmm. my first measure of defense for something. But I, you know, sometimes when I'm watching, even when I watch the boys and I watch when I worked in school, and there were times when I would be like, you know what, if you just gave that kid a slug, I'm telling you, he would just stop, you know, like, so there was sometimes when I felt like, you know, you're being tortured by somebody emotionally, really, it's right. emotional most of the time, absolutely tortured. They don't know how to get out of it. They don't know how to walk away from it. You won't stop. And I see why it would come to that, why it would come to physical blows. Right, yeah.
Right. And this is where a rules-based culture does not have space for humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Because if that were to come to blows and they were surrounded by understanding people, then it would be processed as a step that was sad and unfortunate.
Yeah.
But within the realm of what was understandable and effective, yeah. though not necessarily recommendable, but understood.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. That's exactly right. Yeah. Not at all.
Yeah. So, and we need to live in those gray spaces.
That's exactly right. And, you know, and I would even go, for me, I would even try to walk somebody out of even responding that way, but it's not because I don't understand what happened. You know, like.
Right. Yeah, not, yeah.
You know,
if they can hear a better way that they can own. The problem is in those moments, you have to act in a way that has integrity. And this is getting is getting back to what you were saying a few minutes ago about space and whatnot. A lot of these kinds of biases and defending our space has each of us has a different notion of the texture, of the firmness of the boundaries, of the solidity of the stance, of our space. Some people, you know, there's almost no there in a sense that they're just so nimbly moving around and away or under things. But other people, they're almost too there, you know, and they're really there. But you really have to treat them differently, and each one will defend their space differently.
I agree, 100%. I came to that. Again, that idea of like trying to understand, I use the word foundation, the foundation of who we are, the foundation of somebody's character or personality.
The foundation of their bias.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And some of it's more, some people's are more shaky than other people's. Mm-hmm. And so there's a different response, defense response from them that right. comes. And for me, in terms of like making peace, one of the ways I do that is to try to understand that more. And it reminds me, I was saying this to a friend the other day, that my husband was almost 20 years older than I was. And there was a point in which, so I was in my 20s, he was in his 40s when we met. There was a point at which, as he got older, I realized that there was a lot of foundation that wasn't as strong anymore in him. Uh-huh. And so I had to change the way I argued or I approached things because I was dealing with a very different person. And I realized that that's just the truth about all of us, that we often move into different phases of the kind of construction of our foundation. And or we're just there right now, and we have to be able to understand that and recognize it.
Right. And so you have just used the word foundation in a way that I don't know if I've ever heard it used before.
Mm-hmm.
So when you met, when he was in his 40s and you were in your 20s, by the time he's in his 50s, his heart is going to have been stretched and pulled in ways that it hadn't been pulled when he was in his 40s. That's part of his foundation. By the time he's in his 60s, some of the cognitive stuff is going to be shifting, and there's mm-hmm. going to be that stuff. And the physical stuff was probably already beginning to change when he was in his 40s. And those things combined provide a foundation.
Yes, that's right. And that was, I really just recently, I've been aware of that for years, But just recently, I realized that I have to apply that in more ways when I'm dealing with people in general. And that has helped me go, okay, I am now at peace with that other person.
Right.
You know, and not because we agree, not because, you know, I can still think they're a jerk, but because I realize that I don't have to, I just have to shift things in myself to be able to respond and have some sort of mutuality with who their foundation is and who they are as a person.
Right.
You know?
Right. And we're going to, and we're going to make mistakes. I was a teacher in a prison for youth.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the residents was challenging me, and I met him at every escalation point, because to me it was important to do that, mm-hmm. to not concede authority mm-hmm. and control in the classroom. But it got ratcheted up so high that when he went to his next class, he exploded on another student and ended up with a felony that extended his stay. And I never would have wanted that, but at the same time, and I don't know if I could have handled it differently, but at the same time, his reaction is his reaction.
Yeah.
And my reaction is my reaction. And the value to me was that I was in the classroom and respected, or at least engaged as one that could not be walked over.
Absolutely.
I do not know if I could have won that by a different means.
Okay.
But that's the question that I ask myself, you know, as we talked about earlier.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, I in the moment, or at the time, in that snapshot,
sure. Yeah.
That we don't know how else to do it, and we feel like there is no other way to do it. And sometimes we don't, it reminds me of Alcoholics Anonymous that always tells people to make amends when they can.
Sure.
Yeah. There are times when you can't.
Right.
That's just a human reality. I like the idea that when I do those kind of things, when I push somebody maybe a little bit too hard, or I just wasn't tender enough in relation to who they were, the foundation of who they were, that I often will go back mm-hmm. to them and say that.
Right.
Or say, I owe you an apology, and this is why.
I did not say that.
No,
but I
no.
also did not glare at him. I received him back in the classroom.
Ah, yes, very good.
And we worked together.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He did not, it was a hiccup in his life.
Yeah.
That I may have contributed to, or it may have been the day that he just needed to
push harder
than anybody else could take.
That's right. Yeah.
Let's cut to music. What do you have anything specifically in mind for now? Or
yeah, there's a song by a guy named Jelly Roll called "Son of a Sinner."
Never get lonely. I got these goals to keep me company. I took the rear view off of this old Ford, so I only see in front of me. Now the past is out of sight and out of mind. Swore I'd change, now I'm back chasing these white lines. I'm just a long-haired son of a sinner, searching for new. Pretend to be my friend. I'm done for the last time. I'm lying to myself.
myself again. I always say that I'm on my way back here somehow. I should know by now. I'm just a long-haired son of a sinner, searching for new.
This is the Made of Clay Report. I'm sitting here with my co-host, Eric Clay, and I'm Peaches Gillette. And we are having a conversation about bias, news, how things we're taken in, and understanding people's foundations and how we can shift our own behavior and our own foundations sometimes in order to create that peace that I'm always looking for. If you'd like to chime in, that would be great. Give us a call at
607-319-5445, extension 6, or send an email to info@madeofclay.org. 607-319-5445, extension 6, or info@madeofclay.org. So Peaches, can we stay on bias?
Yeah. Yeah.
Where do you want us to go with this topic of bias?
Yeah. You know, there are it might be really clearly just about where we are in this world and in this country in terms of our politics and how we take these biases and not just accept them as just part of who we are when we're creating our foundation, but we use them as tools of war against one another. And that's what troubles me more than anything, that to some degree, we are not allowed to have a bias in one direction or the other. And it is made very clear to us that we're not allowed to do that. And that's what causes more conflict than the bias itself. That we don't allow ourselves to say, look, this is who we are as human beings. Just like we can be physical when we need to, that's who we are as human beings. Bias is who we are as human beings. And as long as I'm not disrespecting you or trying to diminish you based on your bias, then we have to be allowed to have those things and not look at them as like the marking of the enemy, which is what we do in this culture.
Right, right.
The idea that, and you know, sometimes I feel like my mind just goes in weird directions. The idea that we are accepting of everything is a farce. The idea that we are welcoming of everybody is also a farce. The idea that we don't set up parameters to our lives or our daughters, who's of which guy they bring home, or our sons or whatever, is not true.
Right.
And if we can reckon with that reality that it's not true, I think we'd be in a much better place instead of living in this fantasy that to be nice, really, really super nice or perfect, is to pretend that we just accept anything that comes our way and it's just not real. And I think that bias, the whole idea of bias, has gotten woven into that concept that if you have a bias, then it's just so wrong, no matter what the bias is.
Right. And I think there's a funny sort of way in which this idea of being cosmopolitan, of being really willing to taste and play with anything and kind of expecting everybody's, in a certain sense, from a cosmopolitan point of view, there are no stable values. You know, you try on the fashion of the week or the month or the year or the decade, and you look for the house and the status and the standing so that you can be seen in the cosmopolitan area in the way that it actually works. And it is very Machiavellian in that it doesn't matter if you are ethical or true. It matters only that you appear to be so. And that is dangerous. That is really, really, really dangerous. And yet, in many ways, we have political parties now that have polarized on the cosmopolitan ideal, and then its exact opposite, which is a rigid, frozen caricature of value.
That is exactly what is going on. Exactly. You know, I when sometimes when I'm talking about those kind of even your opinions or your biases or the way you think, often I refer to it as a fashion statement, and then when that fashion is out, you will do something else.
Right.
Where I spend my life actually trying not to do that, not to believe in something because it seems like a good fashion statement at the moment, you know, like,
right.
You know, and I find, you know, and I'm not, you know, I love the relationship I have with people, but I do find more often than not that is the way people create their foundation. And so therefore their foundation is always more tenuous. You can have a foundation that changes and shifts with a level of consciousness and a willingness right. to do that. But you can also have a foundation that changes and shifts because somebody told you it should, which right. is not very strong.
Right. And it means you don't have much in the way of personal agency. And in a cosmopolitan world, there's individualism without personal agency.
Yes. Yes.
And to take it to an extreme, in some ways, the Second Amendment gun folks and some of the more right wingers take personal agency to a point of utter disregard of other people. But that's personal right. agency is how you navigate within a sea of relationships, not yes. how you mow down the opposition with that's a gun right. or intimidate them by your presence.
That's exactly right. And I think that for me, when I'm in the face of those sorts of things, and sometimes I just sit back and listen and watch, like I'm observing insects, but sometimes when it makes me ask a million questions. And often people, either they don't know how to answer the question, or they're kind of stumped by the fact that you would even ask a question about something like that, you know? So it's interesting. So it becomes a real, I mean, for me, it's kind of like, I kind of like it because it's a way with like playing with the sails and, you know, taking whatever direction I want to take. But sometimes at the end of the day, I feel like, wow, was I communicating at all with anybody? You know, like sometimes I come out of it feeling that way. And the worst of the more critical side of me says, is that all we use our big brains for? We have these, we brag about these big brains and we don't even use them well. Is that it? You know, like, you know, and there's a sort of wishy-washiness in what I'm describing that is not just about the individual, but it's about the people they're relating to. If you think about that kind of wishy-washiness in terms of being a parent, that wishy-washiness can do a lot of damage to a child. Mm-hmm. In terms of not like just kind of saying, this is who we are as a family, this is what we believe in as a family, and this is what we're going to walk with as a family. Well, those effects also take place with other adults and with friends that you have, and it kind of sets them almost off their own grid because they don't know how to relate to you as a person because you're kind of all over the place with everything. So it doesn't just stay within the individual. Whatever we do, I believe, affects those outside of us, you know?
Right. There's a sense in which, and you use wishy-washy, for me, the rhetoric coming up was whether you're going to be real or you're going to be fake.
Very good.
And the social contract was, you know, you're going to be fake with me and I'm going to be fake with you. And that's going to be all right.
Right.
And that's the social contract in society. And it doesn't lead to good places.
No, it does not.
I'm feeling like we need some kind of specific issue or case or topic to kind of chew on for a bit. And I don't know exactly what that would be. A couple of things have come to my mind, but the other people who were involved with them aren't here to speak to them. And that doesn't on some level feel fair. I was ordained a Christian minister and Christian practice is my root religion, as Thich Nhat Hanh would say. I am skillful in a lot of different worldviews, and I'm skillful in a lot of different biases that I find interesting to work with, but I can put them on and put them off, but I do know where I am. And that's a useful thing, but it's also useful to know how to change clothes and to clean yourself up. And I don't want this to sound like it's too, when you're talking about biases, it's too easy to make it sound like a grievance. Because it's not a grievance. Mm-hmm. It's just a lack of experience.
Yes.
Or a lack of awareness. So yes. The level at which my Christian family is, and most of them don't consider themselves Christians anymore, but the level of their anti-Semitic behavior towards my partner is something of which they are completely clueless. Wow. Absolutely, completely clueless.
Wow.
And yet a similar level of cluelessness around race wouldn't be allowed.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Oh,
And the cluelessness among my many Jewish friends about actual Christian practice,
mm-hmm, okay,
is just wild.
Yeah,
it's just incredible, and yet we don't approach each other with curiosity.
Right,
we approach each other more with judgment or with, oh well, why would there be anything wrong about saying that?
Yes, exactly.
Or why, you know, I did a reenactment of the crucifixion, mm-hmm, of Jesus as a hate crime with a black character reading the part of Jesus. But it was impossible to get any Jewish people to participate except for my partner, who understood the intent of, yes, the performance, and not as an effort to re-attack Jewish people, but as an effort to understand bias.
Yes.
Gone bad.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes. It's interesting because we're also cultivated to, I said this before, to be defensive. So even if we show an innocent, quote unquote, innocent curiosity about the other, it is taken as an attack on some level. Like, why are you even questioning that? Why? When I, you know, as a child, and that's the beauty of children. Like, children, I grew up in a white neighborhood, and, you know, there were, of course, there was terrible racism. But as children together, there was this amazing curiosity about the other person.
Right.
The other person's looks, the other person's, the fact that they sunburned. They, like, all this curiosity that was not ever taken as a defensive or an offensive thing. It just wasn't taken that way. And so you got more answers as a young child. And now we've kind of grown up into this culture. Like, if you ask somebody where they come from, God forbid, that's just, you know, like an attack on their, on who they are as a person.
Right.
And I miss the fact that we can't just ask questions.
Right.
Or even make compliments, for that matter.
Right. Right.
You know, one of the wonderful things that, to me, in my experience, was when there was more of an influx of Jewish people into Park Slope, where I grew up, it was another wonderful opportunity to get to know somebody with different faith, with different belief, who had a different history or things like that. And we talked about it with kids, with Jewish kids, the ones who would expose themselves, because at the beginning of the 70s, they wouldn't expose themselves. But we did have those conversations, and they turned into loving friendships and loving conversations that are now completely lost, you know, or to a large degree are lost.
They may be lost to time, but we don't have an environment now where we can actually discover them so easily. Although I am assuming, in the same way that we turn to news sources that are not condoned by our friends, we will also make friends that are not condoned by our friends. I do think we still do that because we are interesting and squirrely and headstrong people. And sometimes it's good in a headstrong in a good way.
Yeah.
I always have a hard time when somebody says something with utter confidence and I propose an alternate view.
Okay.
That can be my negating their view, or it can be my saying, I don't think it's set that particular way necessarily. And then one person came back to me recently with wrong.
Okay.
And I pushed back a little bit. I didn't say I was right, because I don't necessarily know that I'm right. Right, but I'm pretty sure that I'm not just completely wrong. I don't think this is the geometry question that I messed up in junior high. I think this is something slightly different than that. And there may be space in the universe for both of us and more.
Yes.
And what I'm trying to say by this is that people hold on to the correctness of their biases. Because they're alone.
Okay.
And on some level, they do not have people who will stand with them as the hypocritical, the wonderful, the depraved, the whatever they are as human beings, that so that it doesn't so matter so much.
That's right.
That their bias be the truth.
Right. That's right. Right. Yeah.
And so we're immensely lonely.
Oh, no doubt.
And then, but we have these choruses of correctness.
Yes.
Whether coming out of the right or the center or the left. And
you know, I often approach things that, you know, when someone says something, I think like, that's sounds crazy. I often say to them, I wonder if I looked at it in this other way, would I begin to see something different in that? You know, or even I'll say to people, I wonder if I don't look at it that way, but I wonder if I looked at it that way, if I see something different in the way I think, You know, and I do that as a model to model kind of mirror a behavior. Because it is, I think it ultimately, I remember as a child, I grew up in church, in a Baptist church, and, you know, was taught about God and everything. And I remember in the middle of the night, one night, waking up and going, wow, what if there really isn't a God? And I felt afraid.
Mm-hmm.
So my point is that sometimes when we shake people's foundation, it scares them. And so I try to approach it in a very different way that in some way doesn't seem like I'm trying to shake up your foundation, but just I'm curious about your foundation kind of thing.
Right. So that's I'm curious about your foundation. It's also, have you ever had to have what you held to be most true and most essential that you do, have you ever had it fail and had to learn something different?
Exactly.
What did you learn from that process that brings us? Yeah.
That's beautiful. That's the beauty of language. We can just craft things in such amazing ways to get to the same point,
right,
that we would some other way.
But it's drawing on their reflective experience. And mm-hmm. even though many of us are highly reactive, we do know when we've changed the calculus or we've changed the course a little bit.
That's exactly right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
One of the, what you're raising also suggests in me a time when I was the object of my partner's bias. And I was being challenged for a behavior that was, we're both twice divorced. And so we have relationships prior in life of about overall 20 or 30 years of marriage to other people before we got together. But I was being challenged for doing something that did not feel like me.
Okay.
And I had the presence of mind, rather than to become defensive in the moment, to say to her, which of your first two husbands are you speaking to?
Mm-hmm. Yes, very good.
And her, a friend of hers was present, and she just busted out in laughter. And Amy kind of smiled and realized that this may not have been the most accurate response, that there may have been a kind of a bias that she was carrying that hadn't been changed. And we had a laugh rather than a fight.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I love that. I love that. And the funny thing is that I think back, you know, I grew up in Brooklyn. We also grew up in a world where we just weren't like this. We weren't oversensitive and delicate and whatever. Where, you know, you would say to somebody, what are you, crazy? Like, how could you think that way? And we would have a laugh over it.
Right.
You know what I mean? It didn't turn into like a drama about hate and which side of the lines you're standing on. It just didn't turn that way. And then we'd move on to something else.
Right.
And maybe come back to it another time. But that was it.
Right. And you're saying, I mean, if you know, because we're close to the same age, and even though we grew up in rural versus urban backgrounds, language, I think, was more similar than not. Mm-hmm. When you say somebody you're crazy, it was like, you know, I think that's nuts.
That's
whereas
right.
Now you're crazy is that you're kind of like beyond the pale. You're kind of more than three standard deviations from the mean. You know, it's like you're not acceptable.
It didn't
have that weight.
That's right.
It wasn't, to say it was not as big an indictment, to receive it was not as big a judgment.
That's exactly right.
You know,
without a question. I mean, yeah, there was. I don't think we ever said anything charming when we were questioning somebody's thinking, and it was part of the way we accepted one another. That's who we were.
Yeah,
and it was taken lightly.
And when somebody would say to me, or I would say to them, "You're a flaming idiot." The flaming would be the visual reflection of the anger we felt in the conversation and the utter disrespect we felt like we were getting from our point of view.
That's a good one, I have to tell you. I'm not going to use it, even though I'm tempted. That's good.
Let's take a break for music because I have something I would like to ask you about, and I want your opinion on it.
To you, do I look complete? Now take one more look past my celebrity. That's where you'll find the real me. To you, do I still look complete?
I got every material thing I could ever need. I got the love from my fans that adore me. And I'm grateful.
And I thank you so very much.
This is a Made of Clay report. I'm here with co-host Eric Clay, and we're having a conversation about many things: bias, news, information, our conditioning, where we stand in life. And we would love it if you called in and gave us your thoughts about it. And you can call in at 607-319-5445, extension 6, or you could email us at info@madeofclay.org.
So Peaches, you know, after the, I've been living my perception. I came from a place that was deeply purple and community oriented, but the agricultural economy was just devastating the community from the 1920s and earlier on, probably from the late 1890s. There were a few people who still had the generous wisdom and the open eye to be able to hold bias and to respect it, but not feel like you needed to bow to it, or, you know, you need to become subservient to anybody's bias. You just need to accept it and acknowledge it and work with it. And I have seen since the early mid 1970s, the split in the country that many people didn't become aware of until 2016, 2015. We saw a flourishing of efforts to have dialogue among different groups. Yep. And I felt that that was completely wrongheaded.
Okay.
Well-intentioned, but completely wrongheaded, because these differences that animate our lives, you know, they're how we walk, they're how we greet each other, they're how we feel affection or disaffection toward each other. These biases are our whole being.
Mm-hmm.
And when you intellectualize it, you either have to have polite conversation or you kind of engage in something of a free-for-all. But if you're not really engaged as people in a more subtle way, I would say even in a more physical way, handing each other food, mm-hmm. or talking about what it means to greet the other person, yeah. and how much you really do welcome them or how you're suspicious of them, and mm-hmm. really getting clear about that,
yeah,
and honest. So the work of addressing our biases is not something we're going to do in rational dialogue,
mm-hmm.
or at least we're not going to. We rational conversation may be part of it, but it's not the heart of it.
I agree.
So what are your thoughts on how to do this?
Yeah, I think about that all the time. And in my mind, it's just like, you know, we have to almost shed a certain skin that we have, that we carry around, understanding that that skin is not even necessarily the skin that we grew ourselves, but the skin that somebody else put on us. And we have to shed that skin of like, of just being, and maybe part of it is just trusting. It's not even necessarily trusting the other person, but trusting yourself to be able to stand steady no matter what comes your way, and to kind of pull it apart and put it back together in a way that we don't have to be fighting constantly with one another or look at people as the enemy, to really kind of like, I think, move in a little bit more, even with the things that, like, you know, people say, even with the things that make us really uncomfortable, to kind of lean in and ask more questions. And to, you know, there's this great book called As a Man Thinketh. And I don't remember the author. I think it's not Alan Watts. But anyway, James Allen. It talks a lot about how if we can think ourselves into what's negative, then we can think ourselves into what's positive. And I deeply believe that it is not some outside force. There are outside forces that give us information, but those outside forces don't influence us to believe in that information. And we have much more control over the things that we take in. So we don't have to be constantly defensive. We don't have to look at other people as being the enemy. And we just have to take it upon ourselves and not wait for somebody else or some other dictator, something in the culture to tell us that we don't have to be that way. We don't have to be that way. We have a mental, intellectual choice and an emotional choice to not be that way. And I think that we have to just understand that in ourselves, strengthen in ourselves, and just kind of drop all of this defensiveness that is creating wall after wall after wall again between more and more communities,
right,
about right, more right. and more things, and some of them are just not even important.
Right. So I think, so I want to recognize that there's an array of less important to more important.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been having conversations. I I live life in relationship to a lot of people who do kind of applied science kinds of things, whether it's healthcare or building or food or whatever. And I've been in conversation with a person around issues of nutrition.
Yes.
And at the level of any individual person, we know very little how to really predict nutrition for an individual person, what would be a good diet.
Yes.
People need to sort that out on their own. And they're going to have strong opinions. And for many people, food is the closest thing to religion they've got.
Yes.
Because they have really strong opinions. And the scientist in this particular case is really a good-natured person, but you know, when they feel like the other person wants them to, they can't just hold that other person's attitude to nutrition or food that happens in a different way. They have to stand away from it or apart from it because it violates.
Mm-hmm.
Their core understanding, rather than saying we can create a world that has space for both of us.
Yeah, I know.
You know, and so I don't know how to embody that process, because I think that's what's missing in this historic moment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, by the same token, there are people who would deny the right to exist, say. People who are extremely anti-Semitic, and so you can't. It's you don't create a safe space with the anti-Semite.
That's right.
But short of a person trying to kill you,
yes.
or remove your people from the country,
yes.
you can find a space. Where you can share different spaces, because you may never want to be. But I tell you, there are many people of a similar background to me that I don't want to spend time with.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't want to be with them, you know, for a whole host of reasons. but so the religion isn't just the determinative factor here. But we lose a nuanced way of thinking about how, you know, there are some differences that are just so small as to not be important. And we can flag them and they should be fairly quick. There are some differences that are going to cause us to create space, allow for practices, allow for customs that we may find offensive, allow for hunting animals, allow for having pets that we may find on some level morally wrong, but it's within their freedom to choose. And we haven't collectively decided that it's not. But we have collectively decided that we can't annihilate people simply because of their religion or race or economic class. At least we have tentatively decided that. Some of us have.
Yes.
How do we contain, how do we have this conversation? Because the conversation about bias, from my point of view, became... bias is bad because somehow we manufactured middle-class America, that which was kind of coherently cosmopolitan or at least plain vanilla.
Right, right.
And we manufacture that, and then everything beyond that is simply not good. But there are no people there. That's an abstract idea. People are ornery. People have things that they like and that they don't like, and things that they're not honest about, and things that, you know, so anyway, I'm rambling.
Eric, we don't even, all of the things that you just said, the things that we were saying together, we haven't even begun conversations about the reality of human bias. We haven't even started that conversation, let alone look into, like, yes, there are biases that are absolutely walking you into destruction, of destroying other people, even into destroying yourselves if you have a lot of self-hate, whatever it is. But it doesn't mean, it's like everything else. It's like the fact that we are capable of hating, the fact that we are capable of violence, all of those things are part of who we are. Bias is part of who we are as a human being. The question becomes, what do we do with that bias? What purpose does our bias serve? Can it serve a good purpose as opposed to a lousy purpose in annihilating another person? And I haven't even begun to have those conversations with people in any way, let alone to start talking about how we can remove ourselves, as opposed to, let's have a conversation of what bias really means, not that it's just a negative dark force in all of us. What does it really mean? Why is it part of the human package to begin with? So what purpose does it possibly serve?
Right. You know? Right. Right. I want to jump into a fairly simple, at least it's simple to describe, notion of bias. And I think it's because we lack examples that are relatively easy to talk about, even though they're not easy to resolve. So I'm going to make an absolutely outrageous claim, which, you know, I have a lot of fun doing. And the outrageous claim is that in the United States, we don't have a housing problem. We have a relationship problem. Mm-hmm. Okay. We have a relationship problem that means that many people have two homes and they're only in one at a time. We have zoning, which allows us in downtown Ithaca to only have three unrelated people in a house that could comfortably house three couples, or even, you know, even more parents and kids or unrelated people, if they chose to live that way together. But we don't allow it by zoning. And zoning has created a sort of middle class idea of affluence, which jacks up the cost of housing for everybody, but it makes it so we don't have to think about how we could use the space that we have, the assets and the resources that we have, in a way that would have a greater benefit to more people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think about that all the time, and specifically in terms of housing, you know. Yeah, I mean, and especially for somebody like me who came from a Upper East Side private school, where the amount of houses, literally, that some of those families had in various countries, three in this country, others in other hemispheres, was really incredible to me, you know.
Right.
And the sizes themselves, I mean, people living in enormous house, three people living in a 6-bedroom house. I mean, can we, with all these ordinances and zoning things, like we're like stuck behind a wall in terms of trying to, even the good people who want to change that, you know, get stuck in certain situations where they can't.
Right. You know? Right.
And it's horrible.
Right. And we could choose to have relationships where we violate the law and push the question.
I agree.
But we also have to take responsibility for the way it may damage the lives of people we love when we do that.
Yeah.
And we have not had a conversation about housing in this country or that deals with the fact that we have enough bedrooms, we have enough space. They're just not going to the right people.
Everything boils down to that for me. Is what are we doing with our resources? Not that we necessarily lack them, not that we necessarily don't have them, but what are we doing with them? And the same thing applies to me with the things that are like just natural to who we are as human beings. What are we doing with our biases? What are we doing with those things? How can we use them to embrace more people anyway?
Right. Well, right, right. So I want, but okay, so... So how, if we were to use our resources in a way that would accept the biases of people, then we would recognize that in this 4-bedroom house, there might be a family of 10 or 15 people that would be delighted to have it and they would take care of it, but I can't rent it to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because there may be, maybe they're not all family. Maybe it's a little cluster of people.
That's right. That's right.
You know, So if we look at our resources and not the fact that we're biased in the use of the resources, But how can everybody's biased perception of resources to some extent be accommodated? The people who are going to be pinched are those who want orders of magnitude larger than their fair share.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And I say orders of magnitude because we are fundamentally different critters. Mm-hmm. As a field biologist, some people are going to mm-hmm. have a big impact on the amount of land. They're going to have a big impact on the amount of water. Others are going to have, and we impact resources differently.
That's exactly
right. And having space for that allows for there to be huge variation, but still there's within some limits.
Yeah.
I mean, and this was this phrase, which goes back to the 1970s. And it was too much associated with kind of a denial of diversity. It was too associated with Christianity.
Okay.
Live simply that others may simply live.
Ah, yes, I know that phrase. Yes.
And that phrase cuts at another bias that we have, which is that every economy, in order to be strong, has to be growing. And for an economy to grow, people have to consume more. For people to consume more, the only real evidence that that has happened is that there are more BTUs of energy burned when people consume more. Whether they are sustainable energy sources or not doesn't really matter. If there's a product behind that or a service that generates more BTUs, the economy is going to grow, but we're going to destroy the environment.
That's exactly right. That's right.
So how do we choose, with each of our biases about the lives we would love to live, mm-hmm. how do we choose a space for our biased ways of life, so that everybody gets what they find really essential?
Yes.
And can figure out what they're willing to let go of.
And I think that's the key. The key is to figure out what we're willing to let go of. You know, and there are people who are not willing to let go of much. They really aren't.
Right. But this is like the conversation about bias. We haven't had the conversation about bias, mm-hmm. but we also have not had the conversation about what would you let go of?
Yeah.
What would you hold ever more dearly if you mm-hmm. were able to let go of some of the stuff that's taking your time, bleeding your resources or whatever, that would be kind of helpful to just let go of?
Right. You know? No, it's true. We don't have those conversations. You know, I find those to be not necessarily for me, but when trying to present that. You know, it comes up all the time in terms of like the constant discussion about resources. This is a constant discussion. But then when it gets to that other level of like, okay, so what are we willing to give up in order to spread our resources or use our resources mm-hmm. in a very different kind of way that encompasses so many more people, the same people that on the other side of our brains we're worried to death about. What are we willing to give up for them? There was a conversation that I had with someone where there were low-income housing units being built in their area. And part of the outcome of building those was that the people who own houses over a certain amount of money, like $300,000, their taxes would go up a few dollars. And I mean, I really mean a few dollars. I'm not mm-hmm. exaggerating. And this was the most ludicrous thing they've ever heard of, that they would not do it. So look at that little bit. Right. Your taxes go up $150 so that other people could have homes. And that sounds ridiculous to you.
Right.
Yeah. It's shocking sometimes to me.
Right. And so when I've encountered that kind of conversation, mm-hmm. What I can almost bet is that the people with the 300 which is slightly above or right around the median price of a home in Tompkins County right now. When people make that pitch, they have not, they don't have any real relationships with people who live on less than $100,000 to $150,000 a year for the household. And if you don't have those conversations and you don't know those people, you could never, you can't imagine giving up, because one thing that's true about all most Americans is that at all income levels, they live just at or slightly beyond their means.
That's right.
At all income levels. So that's there is no empathy. There is no, there is no reservoir of wealth or wealth of empathy for people to take on the concerns of others, because we have lived at both a financial material wealth and an emotional wealth that is near bankruptcy.
Yes, I understand. Yes. Yeah. But and that leads me to say that, I mean, I live a pretty poor life in a lot of terms. And I also ask myself, what could I give up? You know, because the question is still applicable. You know, I live, most people live up to their means and even beyond their means most of the time. Well, I don't have to necessarily.
Right.
So how do we get to that point in our hearts? Because I think that's where it has to come from, you know, and say, what more? I was raised with the concept of, like, it doesn't matter how little you have something to give. If you have something, you have something to give. Right. That was a concept I was raised with.
Right. And if you can't cut it in half, you play with the same thing at the same time with the other kids.
That's exactly right. That is exactly right. So it feels so second nature to me to understand the plights of other people who are in more need or in greater need than I am or anybody else. That's just where my mind goes.
Right. I didn't realize how private property in New York State has been so contested, and people are so mine about it. And even the rural areas were the same way. I grew up in Missouri. If you had a farm and anybody who asked you to hunt on your land or to walk on your land, if they asked you, you gave them permission, it would have been considered inhuman not to do so.
Amazing.
You would warn them about, you know, the cattle are over there, so be careful when you're shooting so you don't, you know, kill a cow or a calf or whatever, or a pig or whatever. But it was just expected that. And also there was kind of an understanding that if you wanted to go over to your neighbor's pond and they had a rowboat, you could use it if they weren't using it, you know?
Yeah, I love that.
And that was just because, you know, this was something that your use of it would not hamper its value. And if you broke it, if you did hamper its value, you replaced it or you restored it to the condition in which you found it.
That's right.
Well, I came to Ithaca and my God, people could not accept you walking, you know, even asking, what do you mean you want to walk on my land? What do you mean? You know, so they have these formal pathways and we have wonderful, you know, hiking trails and stuff, but the legalities around where the right of way can go and where it can't go. And people's defensiveness is really very high. And it's more high in Missouri now because the whole country has become more possessive. But back in the 1980s on Upper Saranac Lake, my partner's family had a little cabin, a very, very rustic, very primitive cabin that we would stay at. And the neighbor had a canoe that they weren't using. They weren't up for the week. So I took it out.
Right.
The furor that went off. The neighbors of the neighbors reporting it to the neighbors reporting it was suddenly as though I had stolen the crown jewels.
Oh my gosh.
Well, No,
I get it.
Yeah, it was more than simply, you know, you shouldn't do that.
Exactly.
It was
exactly.
Like, you, what you did was really wrong. Don't you respect other people's property?
Ah, yes, yes. Okay. Yeah.
You know, how could you do that?
Yeah.
So these are biases.
That's right.
And the bias that says I can have something that would truly benefit another person, their use of it would not damage it for me. That bias is not helpful.
That's right.
You know, we have laws in place, Good Samaritan laws, that allow medical professionals to stop and help, and they're not held liable if things go sideways.
Absolutely, yes.
We could have those sorts of things for other kinds of property.
That is exactly.
We have food recovery laws that allow people to donate food even from their own kitchens.
That's right.
That is still good. That if it, you know, if anything happens that goes sideways, they're not held liable.
That's right.
We could be that considerate, but that we have had to pass laws shows how much mm-hmm. we hate each other.
I know.
Because you only keep people out of what they need when you hate them.
Well, yeah. No, I feel that very heavily. I really do. And it saddened me. And I don't know, there are no pat answers into how we walk ourselves out of this kind of crazy way of not existing
right.
together.
Right. So the point that I was trying to get at that I didn't say clearly is that if each of us were to ask of our friends who have more, that I release some of what I have to those who could really use it.
Yeah.
Especially if it doesn't involve loss, it's just yes. use. But even if it involves a loss that is not damaging to me.
Yes.
But if we don't, so my sense is that it can only work if you are asked by someone you respect to do something that you wouldn't normally do.
Okay, yes.
Because and this is getting back to difference and respect. That's people right. you respect or who respect you can ask you to do things that are not within your value structure.
Yes.
But they can get you to try something yes. you've never done before.
Yes.
And you can, and even asking is going to be hard for people.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Because
yeah.
we don't know how to ask
yeah.
for what we or our loved ones need. We're generally better asking for our loved ones. I mean, the stereotypic case is the woman in a domestic violence situation finally is protecting her children rather than herself.
Yes.
We can often ask for others without asking for ourselves, but That's we need right. to be able to ask for everyone.
That's right. Exactly.
And ourselves.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
And where, no matter where you are on the social hierarchy, there's always somebody above you.
Yeah.
And there's always somebody below you.
That is exactly right. That's right. And to have a mutual kind of asking, because even if I have little means, there are still things I can give. And to just create this system that we don't mind asking one another for things, you know, even if it's like, literally, even if it's like, come over and help me bake this bread, come over and do this. It doesn't have to be anything that I have to necessarily sacrifice that's making my life, you know, less livable.
Right.
But we can exchange services, loving services to one another all the time. You
right.
know, and why not ask for those things, you know?
Right. And if the person is busy, but then your offer of companionship is not needed.
That's exactly right.
And they can say no at no with no. That's but a right. lot of times when people are asked something, they feel like they have to say yes because That's you've laid an obligation on them. So saying yes and no is not just it's not just about asking. It's about knowing how to say yes and how to say no.
Yes. And to hear those things well.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Hear right. them accurately because yeah. I'm busy watching my favorite television show. You know, so or a movie, and so no, I'm not going to do it now. But it's not a rejection of you of a human being.
No, no, and it just means for now.
Yeah, that's
doesn't
right.
mean I'll never do that. You
that's
know,
that's right. That's right. Yeah. That's right. That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
Let's take a break from music. What should do you have something in mind to play now, or shall we just figure it out?
You'll figure it out, yeah.
This is the Made of Clay Report, Facing Our Lives, and Peaches Gillette and I are your co-hosts, and we are exploring, we're exploring perspective, we're exploring bias, we're exploring values, we're exploring how we can choose to live in a way that respects others who might live in a different way or who might need. And we can also, we're also exploring what are the limits of bias and respect. When does it, when does it become damaging or dangerous to encourage or allow things that might hurt us? All of these things. So you can, I mean, I guess I just said we rambled over the universe just now, or the planet Earth. Anyway, if you have comments or suggestions for these conversations, you can call 607-319-5445, extension 6, and we will receive those comments, or you can send them by email to info@madeofclay.org. That's 607-319-5445, extension 6, or info@madeofclay.org. How should we wind this conversation down today?
You know, I love the idea and certainly the question of, like, what do we do to embrace others, even given their biases that don't necessarily match up to ours and our biases that don't match up to theirs, to start to understand how that those things are not the makings of enemies. They're not, it reminds me of like growing up where somebody wore Converse sneakers and somebody wore the other sneakers and suddenly they were like on different
Croydon.
Right?
Converse and Croydon, I think was the
thank
thing
you. Yeah, so I couldn't remember the other one. You know, and even with jeans, right? People wore Lee jeans or Wrangler jeans, and like, and that become like
or Levi,
right? That's right, Levi's too, and all of that. How that became like a way of standing on opposite ends of the size, opposite groups of people that you hung out with. It was just nuts in that way. Well, we're still doing that,
right?
As if we're children, and haven't grown up out of that, and realized that the world needs more care than that. The world is bigger than that. And we have to figure out how to walk ourselves out of that underdeveloped state of being.
Right.
Even as we look at all the things that are falling apart in this world that are affecting each and every one of us. The climate is going to destroy each and every one of us. It's destroying our animals. It's destroying everything. You know, lack of food is killing people. All of these things affect all of us ultimately. When you're a kid, you don't realize that. When you're an adult, you must realize that and then start having the conversation of how do we unwind that? How do we unwind that simple way of looking at life in terms of that it's okay for us to stand on opposite ends? Well, when you get older and bigger and more sophisticated, standing on opposite ends becomes much more destructive.
Right.
You know, and we have to undo that.
Right. Yeah. I'm not sure. I'm just not sure we can have that conversation until we've kind of just pondered the question of, do I really need what I have?
Nice. Yeah.
Do I need to? I have a big physical appetite. I eat a lot, and I also like to cook food. But do I need to be choosing to purchase food that maybe hasn't traveled as far?
Yes.
Around the globe, or maybe hasn't, or maybe that's more in season and requires less storage, or maybe was preserved, canned, or frozen in a way that keeps it even more nutritious than fresh, quote, fresh food, because it was processed at the time of its peak nutritional value. Or what, you know, but that's part of my own squirrely head, having grown up on a subsistence farm. And one of the things about subsistence farmers is you know that you don't necessarily have enough to eat year round.
That's right.
You do your best to make that happen, but it's not always guaranteed.
Yeah. I like that question very much. Like what? That's the bottom line in so many, just not on a physical level, it's really even on, you know, an emotional, spiritual level. What am I willing to let go of in order to attain a way of taking care of one another in the best ways that we can?
Right.
People hold on to emotional things that don't do that. They hold on to spiritual things that don't do that. That to me should be the question. Like, is this embracing as many people as I need it to embrace or want it to embrace or think it should embrace in terms of giving up whatever properties, rooms, whatever it is that you're giving up?
You're making me think kind of more on a macro level too.
Uh-huh.
I have never heard this considered, but it's simple and it is I think it's at least not a bad question.
Okay.
You know, inflation is generally driven by the fact that there are more dollars chasing goods than there are goods being chased.
Mm-hmm.
And what if there were a kind of a suggestion or an invitation to purchase less in a time of inflation, and particularly in targeted industries?
Yes.
So that, you know, they would either have to adjust or whatever, but the pressure on inflationary prices would be something that could be managed by an informed individual behavior.
That's right.
Rather than by managing monetary policy.
I agree 100%.
I don't know that I agree with what I just said. I just know it's a good question.
I think it's a good question, but I do agree. I think about that all. I have to say that there's a part of me that's a very, very, you know, heart-oriented, grassroots kind of person that feels like we don't wait until somebody else fixes the problem. We have to start to fix the problem within ourselves and spread that out, you know?
Right. But
I don't
for
think we do that. Yeah.
No, but. Right. So you enter the world with a powerful sense of personal agency, and people with a sense of personal agency can change their actions on a dime. but they need good information that suggests where actions would collectively make a difference. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do see what you're saying.
And that requires, well, this takes us back to the beginning of the conversation. That takes us back to news sources perspectives that actually assess problems in a way that we would like to know, that would be able to help us make a small contribution that we could not see its impact.
Yes.
But because we know other people are thinking in that way and making similar choices, we could have six different policies for reducing carbon emissions. We could have 100 different efforts to reduce inflation if we could trust that we're hearing information that would be usable, that we could make actions on, and then we could follow up and see, well, how many people acted? What was the outcome?
That's right.
You know, that's the tension between the, it's not strictly grassroots, because the analysis, the perception, the conversation needs to happen at both levels.
On all across. Levels.
Yes, at all levels. Yeah.
That's exactly right. And to be able to, like we are saying the whole time, is to be able to not stand. You know, some people hear things that they know on some level is true or right or workable or beneficial. Right. And they still, because it was against something they believed, they will not allow it in.
Right.
So we have to get to a point where we can open ourselves and free ourselves of these kind of automatic defensivenesses that don't allow us to take in even the news that's helping us sort out what we need to do.
Right. I guess I'm gonna back up on that a little bit.
Yep.
Because one of the things that I learned coming from Missouri, the Show Me State, people will resist you. The first reaction is no, show
that's
me.
Right. That's right.
And sometimes they don't even want you to try to show them.
I agree. That's right.
And this is what you're saying. But what I have learned is that if I come back and show them what I did, you know, you don't have to adopt this. I'm not expecting you to agree with me.
Yeah.
I just want you to know about it.
Yes.
And over time, those absolute no's, those shutdowns, actually many of them open up. They don't necessarily change their behavior, but they don't attack you.
Yes.
They don't poison the well for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And we need those relationships too.
That is exactly right. And that's one of the reasons why when we were talking earlier, I was talking about going back.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Going back. That's right. Because you just don't know. You know what I mean?
Right.
And
right.
To me, it's always worth a try. Yep. You know?
I've enjoyed this conversation, Peaches, and I hope that we will hear from some listeners about what to continue to build on, or what to change, or what was that about?
That's
which
great.
I'm willing to hear as well.
And we won't be offended.
No, and even if we're hurt, we know we'll get over it.
That is right.
Even if it's a screaming rant, you know, we'll try to understand.
Right. That's right. But yeah. Good to be with you, always.
Yeah, good to be with you. Thank you. Yeah. And do you have a thought of a song to close with?
It's What's a Kelsey Ballerini song. It's called What I Have.
Thank you. Till next time.
All right. Bye-bye.
My neighbor's grass is the hit of the street, but that don't mean mine ain't just as green. I've been comparing shiny new toys. It's just the root of the thief in my joy. I know that's just the pony show. 'Cause I got a root. got the shoes where the bottom is red, but who the hell am I trying to impress? When you sit back, that's when you notice the Joneses can't even keep up with the Joneses. I know, don't gotta shine to be gold, 'cause I got a roof. Good eyes to see, got so much more